Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a moment from the Movie Geeks United Archive.
Tonight, the Movie Geeks go inside the classic Gone with the Wind. Who better to begin with than one of our most respected and insightful film critics, Molly Haskell. Obviously, in the world of film criticism, you're the foremost authority on gender roles in film. And Scarlett is such a complicated, at times, contradictory character. And I'm wondering, how much was that character of her time and ahead of her time?
Well, I think she's almost out of time in one way, because, as you say, there is something so contradictory. I mean, she's so exasperating. You want to wring her neck one minute, and the next minute you want to forgive her and sort of embrace her. Out of time and yet timely in so many different eras, because she was a jazz, and Margaret Mitchell was writing this really in the 20s. It didn't come out until 36, but she had stopped writing in 1930. So it really wasn't about the Depression, although when it came out in the movie, people thought of it as the Depression fable. But she was really a jazz-age heroine. That's what Margaret Mitchell was, and she sobered up later and became a sort of Melanie figure. But in her 20s, she was a bit of a wild woman. And Scarlett came out of that. The whole emphasis on youth and not wanting to get older and not wanting to marry. You have this in F. Scott Fitzgerald, these heroines that think marriage is a dirty word. And so that's something very ever-present. It's what is woman's role in the new order? And we've been asking our question that in different ways for the last, you know, seven decades.
We've got a great show for you guys tonight. A little bit later on, we're going to bring on director Ken Kwapis. He has a new film called Big Miracle, starring Drew Barrymore, that's out now on DVD and Blu-ray. And we're going to welcome on also some filmmakers from the Los Angeles Film Festival that's going on now. But first, let me bring on my co-hosts, Jerry and Dean. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hello.
Hello, hello. Our opening clip, because we've been opening our shows with some archived clips lately, that was from a show a couple of years ago that we did paying tribute to Gone with the Wind as our Inside the Classic series. And our guest for that show was Molly Haskell, who is an extremely celebrated film critic and author and a longtime wife and as of today, the widow of another terrifically celebrated film critic, Andrew Saris. And I wanted to open up the show talking about the legacy and the contribution of Mr. Saris to film criticism and film culture as a whole. And to do that, I wanted to bring on our great friend, Mr. Keith Ulick, critic for Time Out New York. Keith, are you there, buddy?
Yes, hi, how are you?
You are here. I really appreciate you joining us tonight, especially on such short notice, but I mean, you're such an essential voice on the show, and I really wanted your contribution to this conversation, so thank you.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, the articles are appearing now, the kind of tributes to Mr. Saris, and I saw in The New Yorker, someone wrote in The New Yorker, Andrew Saris is the one indispensable American film critic, and this was obviously the magazine for which Pauline Kael wrote.
Right.
And Roger Ebert said he was the most influential American film critic of his time and one of the jolliest. Do you agree with those assessments?
Oh, I mean, yes, to a degree, although as I'm hearing all that, I mean, you know, when someone passes away, obviously the voices tend to be really hyperbolically praising. And I met Ferris and I interviewed him. I had the good fortune to do that in 01. And what I found, and I said that in my introduction at the time, was that he was very modest. So I kind of am hearing all these like praiseworthy words, and it's just like I'm kind of wondering if he might scoff a little bit at it and just kind of go, let's get back to the movie already. Because I was just picking up his book, The American Cinema. I was flipping through it, kind of in a quick preparation, and I saw a line here that just struck me, where he said, this book is intended for those perennial cinephiles, the solitary moviegoers. And, the solitary moviegoers, I just feel like what he meant by that in some ways is the individual, and the individual perspective, and that this was not necessarily, unlike Kale, I think, who did foster acolytes in her own way, for ill, for worse, this is not really, I'm not trying to blame her for anything here, but I think why I tend to gravitate towards Ferris is he spoke to me more as an individual. It wasn't like, you must agree with all my positions. Rather, you can use my positions as a sounding board to make up your own mind.
Right.
And that's what, I try to emulate in my own work. Not to have people parrot my opinions, but perhaps to use the opinions that I have.
Excuse me, Keith.
You
just probably said, summed up probably the most important thing that's missing from civil discourse in anything. I mean, I'm not being, not to go on a hyperbole or anything, but I mean, someone who has been, yourself, who's been in a position for taking an unpopular stance on a popular film,
right.
I think you've just summed up, what is probably the most important thing. It's something that we've seen just obliterated in the last 10, 15 years, oh, maybe even longer than that. It isn't it's not the art of agreeing, forget that. It's to say, okay, use this as a point of reference.
Yep.
You may disagree or agree, whether right, we're getting, neither is wrong, but you really just sort of summed up what's missing. You just summed up the heart of civil discourse in this in our society that's sadly lacking.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, film criticism has never been about, consensus about, the worth of a film or whatever. It's also never been necessarily about reading somebody's opinion and deciding whether to go and see the movie or not. For me, film criticism lives as an art unto itself, and what's most important about it is very simply whether you enjoy reading the person. Reading their writing. That's the key thing.
It's the key thing is their writing. Just as you would any journalist or any writer for that matter. I think that's the problem. I hate to say it, but I think, and I'm part. I'm definitely guilty of this. But I think in the last decade with the internet, especially, I think we fostered either this you're with us or against us kind of atmosphere that exists on here, and not on our show per se, but. And definitely in the message boards across the internet, on the tubes.
Yeah.
And I have really, in the last 3 years, just gutted all that. I don't go to any websites anymore, really. I go to IMDb to check the news, and that's about it. I've lost all interest in interacting with, on Twitter, or anything like that, just because I find it so, it's poisonous in one way, it's too nice, or it's too mean.
Well, I didn't get, and back to Ferris, I didn't get that feeling about him. I listened to a lengthy hour-long interview.
Right.
We'll play a clip from it. I listened to it earlier tonight, and he did seem very jovial, very fair and balanced.
Right.
In his thinking and his articulation about movies. When did you first, when were you first turned on to Ferris, Keith?
I actually, there's an essay that I wrote, there were several I wrote for Senses of Cinema that kind of went with that interview back in 2001, and as memory serves, and I should have read it again before talking with you guys, but I'm pretty sure what it was Gottfried Cheshire, who was a fellow film critic who I also really loved at the time, was a big influence on me, wrote for the New York Press. We became friendly, and we went into a bookstore one day, and he pointed out The American Cinema. And that's Andrew Saris's, you know, famous book with all the directors and the that I just read the little quote from, and it has the categories like Far Side of Paradise and Pantheon directors and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed it and said every cinephile must have this book in their library. And I remember at the time being a little skeptical. I think probably because I had read something, and I don't remember what it was, where Saris had panned something probably that I liked. To this day, that kind of thing has prevented me from taking David Thompson seriously. But David Thompson is just easy not to take seriously nowadays. Saris, I mean, you know, dig a little deeper into his work, and you see the variety of opinion and the what I would say another thing I try to emulate, the constant curiosity that he had for wherever he was,
mm-hmm.
And for whatever was in front of him. I mean, he was not one that I saw necessarily to write, you know, a piece like Hale wrote, Why Are the Movies So Bad, after she came back from California. You know, he was more about, you know, I think being where he was and reacting to the films that were around him. And I think he did mellow a little bit as he got older. I know there were some medical issues around 88 or 89, But in 2001, he was extremely sharp. He expressed a great fondness for Julia Stiles, which tickled me to no end. and of course, he wrote one of his greatest reviews, I think, actually, at that point, in defense of AI, the Spielberg movie, which he absolutely loved. And he was not a science fiction fantasy fan, but he saw something, he saw the fable-like aspects of that film. And that appealed to him, and he was one of the major voices coming out in defense of the film at the time when it was kind of being vilified in a lot of circles. So that was great to see.
Well,
and just, yeah, go on.
And he also, I mean, he wasn't afraid to go back and reassess filmmakers that he might have missed
of course.
Boat on at first. And I think he did that with Billy Wilder, was
mm-hmm.
one of the highest profile filmmakers he did that with. Just to give a little history on him, I mean, as far as I know, I think in the 50s he spent a lot of time in Paris. And when he came back to the States, he kind of adopted the notion that was going around the filmmaking community there at the time of the auteur theory. He kind of introduced that to the American lexicon. And the auteur theory essentially states that the director is the ultimate author of a film, and that's kind of a sense that has stayed with us. I mean, it's part of the way we view films now as a whole, isn't it?
Indeed, and I think, you know, when we get into the nitty gritty and the specifics of it, I always feel like I'm kind of misdescribing the auteur theory. So I kind of want to proceed a little cautiously here, because I think what it meant in Paris is not necessarily what it meant when he brought it here, in the sense that I think he, you know, it's sort of like you translate something, you know, from one language to another. I think a lot of what you're talking about is essentially what it is, about the director as the ultimate author. But I think that there were some cultural things also. God, my French is going to sound awful here. The Les Politiques d'Auteur, or whatever,
well,
you know, which is the French,
that was
French
very
version.
Good.
I think it was probably a terrible accent, and I'm sure I'm going to get criticized for that, but whatever. And then the auteur theory, as it came to be known, you know, here through his kind of translation of it. And certainly, yes, I mean, at a very basic level, I think we can say that yes, it is very director focused, certainly that's a good thing. And again, though, I think. And obviously your creation grows away from you, and so maybe he actually did have kind of a Kale-like effect, only in the sense that a lot of people kind of now take that basic little nugget of the auteur theory and blow it up into kind of the only thing. You know, it's like, and I think, you know, with him, you know, he even says, even in looking in the book, you know, there's no one unified theory of film of how to look at a movie. And so I don't think he would say, he would be strong in his opinions, but I don't think he would say that this is the be-all, end-all. And
mm-hmm.
I guess one of the unfortunate things maybe is that, but I mean, how can you help it? You know, it's just that a lot of people take auteurism is the be-all, end-all of something, and, you know, that does the disservice sometimes to, like, screenwriters, cinematographers, actors, just the general collaborative nature of filmmaking. So,
right.
You know, I think he would say, you know, obviously you have to take a lot of theories and make your own truth out of it. I mean, that's what I try to do. He made his own truth out of it. And I think, unlike Kale, from my dealings, you know, with her just as a reader, never met her personally, I don't think Saris pushed himself, or pushed people to accept his perspective as much as she did.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, and it's, I feel like I might be, you know, there are people I know who knew Pauline Kael very well, and I'm not trying to denigrate her mm-hmm. contribution either. You know, they're two very titanic voices, but I gravitated more towards Saris because I felt that there was a bit more generosity in that perspective. And, you know, that's what I try to emulate in my own work.
Mm.
Do you feel, I got a question for you. Do you feel like it was that essential difference between the two that led to their, you know, kind of famed rivalry?
Rivalry, yeah.
I mean, I'm not really certain. I was reading another thing today. My friend Kevin Lee had the good fortune of having a lunch with Andrew Saris and Molly Haskell with a whole group of people at the Museum of the Moving Image, I think, in 2008. And I believe it was at that lunch that he basically, you know, kind of tried to shoot down the kind of romanticization of film criticism in the 60s when Kael and he were practicing. You know, mm-hmm. I think he was very much a journalism man, old school mm-hmm. journalist in the sense of, you know, it's a paycheck, it's,
right,
you know, a daily grind kind of thing, and out of that can come really wonderful stuff. But I mean, I sort of have a journalism feel, you know, in my own work and stuff, just in terms of like the schedule and everything, and just the sense of what a newsroom is, you know, as endangered as that may be in some ways, you know, Time Out does still foster that kind of atmosphere, and it's a job. There's nothing really to romanticize about it. It's day to day, and I love doing it, and I think he loves doing it. But you know, I don't think that, I you know, when people talk about like him and Kael going at each other and his great line about John Simon where he said he was the greatest critic of the 19th century, that's great, and it makes for good like copy and everything. You kind of look back at that and like, wow. But you know, I think it's important too, and I think what he was trying to steer people towards when he was saying that in 2008 is to not lionize so much that, you know, you're just constantly longing for the past rather than concentrating
yeah.
on where you are. You know, and
I did get that sense, but you know, everything that's being written about Mr. Saris, for the most part, I mean, you can't avoid the Kael Saris kind of legacy and the feud, as imaginary as that might have been. However,
oh, it wasn't imaginary. I mean, don't mistake me there. Yeah, I mean,
well, imaginary in the aspect, at least from a public perspective, that Kael only wrote like one thing once about referencing
circles
him.
And squares. Yeah,
yeah, but you know, I read a quasi obituary that Saris mm-hmm. wrote about Pauline Kael, and
right.
he kind of detailed every kind of encounter he had with her from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
there was definitely no love lost.
No, yes, and they did not see eye to eye, and I guess, you know, I also use that as kind of an instructive thing for me, because I don't really like that. I don't like
mm-hmm.
that people who have such differing opinions can't get along. I mean, I know that, you know, not being naive, there are just some people in this world that we cannot mix with for whatever reason. It's
right.
just, you know, it doesn't work. And you can dime store psychoanalyze all you want, but I mean, it's, you know, they didn't get along is the whole thing of that. And a lot of that came out of their differing perspectives and approaches to film. At the same time, you know, I think again, a lot of people took that as, you know, now we have to divide ourselves into camps, and I hate you, and I hate you, and it's just like, it's just like that's not good for criticism. It's like we need to be together in the same room, and we can argue about our opinions if we so wish, but at a certain point, you know, hopefully we can accept each other as people, you know, and I guess love each other, you know, as people too. And I mean, that's what I take away from a lot of these feuds. First off, is that I think probably they are in some ways blown out of proportion just to kind of mythologize them. But at the same time, there's some very real truth in the antagonism. And I just try to say, well, let's argue our points of view with each other, but let's, best we can, you know, not let the antagonism so divide us that we can't be with each other. You know, because I think if film criticism is going to survive, you know, the troubles that it's in, I think it has to be through building a community, a strong community of not the same voice, not voices parroting each other, but of voices, strong voices expressing a very informed, impassioned perspective on film and on movies and on, ad infinitum, because I don't think, you know, the moving picture art is going anywhere anytime soon.
No.
Well, it's an interesting dynamic, though, because it works as kind of a double-edged sword in terms of Kael Sarris. I mean, they were the two most influential critics at that same period of time.
And Manny Farber was the Holy Ghost, maybe.
Right. And you know, I saw that For the Love of Movies, which is a documentary on film criticism. And I believe Sarris in that film actually said something to the effect, I mean, it isn't verbatim, but he essentially said, you know, to a large extent, we made one another, you know.
Right.
Which is kind of an irony. And you see it in the obituaries for Mr. Sarris that his name is always somehow linked with Pauline Kael.
Yeah, but that's the media, you know.
Yeah.
That's the myth. And there's truth in the myth, but I hope that, you know, we can get to a place where we see him as a person, you know, and in all his complexity. You're going to ask something?
Sorry. Well, you mentioned AI as being a particular favorite piece of writing from him. I think it's the first review he ever wrote. Was it for The Voice, The Village Voice, was it? I think it was Psycho in 1960.
First review for The Village Voice. I think he had written other things before then. I'm a little confused as to, exactly when he started. I know it was before, I think it was before Psycho. I think it was just that his first Village Voice review was Psycho.
But he came out swinging with that review because essentially, I remember Bosley Crowther, he panned the film, and then Sarris came out and said, this is one of the great avant-garde films.
Yeah.
You know, just an absolute rave, like kind of an infamous review that had lasting power. What other reviews of his do you particularly cherish?
I have Confessions of a Cultist here, which, you know, collects his work, actually, and here we go, 1955. So there's an essay in here from 1955. So, I mean, he was reviewing things even before Psycho. Psycho was just, you know, what he had in The Voice, I believe, for the first time. But, I mean, you know, his thoughts on The Birds, anything on Hitchcock, he's really incredible on. I love that he loved I'm trying to see. Yeah, I mean, like, really, it's like the Hitchcock ones that Seven Women. I'm sorry, that's what I was looking for. John Ford's Seven Women, which was John Ford's last movie, really heavily panned, and he championed it, as a movie that he says it's a genuinely great film from the opening credit sequence. I mean, you know, and nobody was, I think, in the big papers at the time was saying that. They were saying it was John Ford having lost, you know, any touch of anything, and Sarris was seeing, you know, poetry and beauty here, where in what was ostensibly just, you know, a bunch of women trapped in a Mongolian monastery, you know, and he was absolutely right. I don't know if you guys have seen the film. Have you?
No, I haven't.
I've never seen it. Never had a chance to.
Yeah, it's an incredible final film because it was the last feature that Ford made, and it just has all these undercurrent. It has this undercurrent of lesbianism in it. It's fascinating, you know, coming from Ford, you know, Mr. American Macho in so many ways, and it's. It has Anne Bancroft basically playing a John Wayne role in it, in a role that I think was originally going to be cast with John Wayne, and then they made it into like a mannish Anne Bancroft doing it. And so, you know, it has these. It's an amazing bridge film, I'd say, between kind of old Hollywood and the newer Hollywood that was taking more chances and. Yeah, you know, that was coming up in the '60s and the '70s in the American cinema. You know, and it was it's an incredible film, and the fact that he defended it, you know, made me want to see it forever. And I would also say another thing: if ever anyone can get a hold of his monograph on Joseph von Sternberg that he wrote for the Museum of Modern Art, I actually. That was one of my interactions with him, was I wanted to read his monograph, which was out of print, and I called him and asked him if I could borrow his copy so I could make a copy of it. and so I went over to his apartment and I got his his copy of it, and he handed it to me. He's like, "Oh, please don't lose it, please." And I was like, I promise I won't. I'll bring it right back. And I took it home and I made a full copy of it, and I have the pages like right here in front of me. They're getting a little bent and, I guess, yellowed and dusty now. But, you know, his insights into von Sternberg were something, too. And that really, got me into looking at his work.
In terms of the films that really captured his imagination and his praise, I want to play this clip from this interview he did in 2000. And he lists some of his favorite films.
I think one of the most underrated periods in movies, strangely, is the 50s. I think I probably have more the great films of all time on my 50s list than any other decade.
What would some of those films be?
Well, my three favorite films, perhaps most people are not familiar with them. One is Max O'Fool's Madame Deux, which was released in America as The Earrings of Madame Deux, with Daniel Derrieux, Charles Boyer, and Vittorio De Sica. That, to me, is the greatest film of all time. It's the most perfect film I've ever seen. The second film is Kenji Mitsuguchi's Ugetsu, Japanese film, which came out around 1953. And the third is Jean Renoir's La Règle du Jeu, Rules of the Game, which was released in America, and that came out around 1939. Now, other people I like Hitchcock very much. Mm-hmm. Vertigo is one of my great films. It'd be on my top 10 list.
Mm-hmm.
John Ford's The Searchers is one of my great films on my list. Orson Welles' Magnificent Ambersons, Louis Buñuel's Belle de Jour, Robert Bresson's O Hazard Balthazar, it's about a donkey, and Fates and whatever. And there are a lot of other people. Currently, some of the directors in recent years that I've admired are Eric Rohmer very much. And I like early Scorsese and Coppola very much. Mm-hmm. I have reservations about both. I think they both have great talent, and they've made some great films, but they I'm not as high as on some of the others. Richard Lester, I think, was always underrated very much.
Now, what are some of his films?
Well, he did Hard Day's Night, for one thing, mm-hmm. but I like some of his late films, like Robin and Marion, and Petulia is one of my favorites, and that was a complete failure, with Julie Christie and Joyce C. Scott. Joyce C. Scott giving one of the most dramatic, beautiful performances I've ever seen.
Yeah, so that's him. That's Andrew Serres talking about some of his favorite films. There was another thing that distinguished Andrew Serres, and I think he was definitely the critic that popularized this practice. He would come out front every year and come out with his top 10 list of favorite films, and that's become a popular practice now. I know
kind of
some
bastardized practice, but
yeah, a bit. But he saw it as a means, as I understand it from reading about him, as a means to just be completely forward and supportive of the works that meant the most to him
right.
throughout the year.
Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not blaming him. You know, it's like again, it's fascinating to look at like the critics of the past, and they do these wonderful things, and then people take these wonderful things, and the further they get away from the person who created it, the more they become kind of like a corporatized thing, to the point that now everybody, you know, myself included, is making lists because they drive traffic. And I'm not just talking top 10 lists, but like, you know, top 100s, top 50s and everything. Not saying it's necessarily all terrible, but, you know, he was using it in a very personal and pointed way, I think. And,
yeah.
You know, I don't, it's kind of like, a colleague of mine wrote an essay on Spielberg's Jaws recently that really just pinpointed something that kind of blew my mind, where he basically said that Spielberg created a genre that only he can work in, and yet that hasn't stopped people from it essentially becoming the dominant mode in Hollywood. You know, and I feel like in some ways you could apply that to a lot of critics. It's like critics, you know, Sarris created something that, you know, is so influential, as did Kale, but it's strangely, it's like only they could work in it to, you know, the highest, and yet here we are, kind of, you know, not quite living up to it, you know, at our best, I'd say. And it's almost like you need some new individual to come along and create something that we can't even yet conceive of, and
right.
I don't know what that would be or how, but I can't help but think that. You know, that has to be the next step in some way.
Well, I love the movies that he championed. And
yeah.
Actually, they're all listed, all of the history of his kind of top 10-year list. They're listed on a website. Maybe we'll go through them later on in the show after our other interviews. But there was a movie that caught my eye that really didn't get much critical praise, and it's a movie that you and I both adore. Empire of the Sun, that was on
yeah.
his top 10 list for 87, I guess it was.
Yeah.
So automatically I saw that and I said, oh, I like this guy.
Yeah. No, me too.
Yeah. But do you find, and I'll end it with this, in terms of legacy and what distinguished him from the majority of film criticism that we see today, do you find that there's kind of a cynicism that runs through criticism today, as though a lot of people that write about film are more in love with the idea of being critical than they are of actual movies?
It's interesting. I'd say this, you know, it's almost like, you know, when you got someone like Gene Siskel, who fell into criticism from, I think, a real estate beat, if I'm not mistaken. I think there was a generation of critics around, you know, that were after Sarris but before the generation coming up now, who kind of fell into, you know, a critical profession and, you know, ultimately, I think, made something of a go at it, but they were newspapermen in a way. And now it's kind of like, you know, the cynicism seems to spring from, you know, you were talking about, I think, Jerry, you were saying something about the internet.
Yeah.
And how it, you know, and the discourse and how it cheapens discourse. And, I mean, my thought is that I think these trolls, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I don't know what else. There's no euphemism for it. That's it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Who are basically, you know, poisoning the discourse in some ways, or attempting to. Let's not even give them...
I'll give you that.
Let's not even give them the ability to poison us. Let's just say they are attempting to. I kind of think that these people have always been there. In the past, they wrote letters to the editor. Now they write comments. And the unfortunate thing is, the unfortunate thing is that, you know, there was a nice lag time between the publication of a review and a letter to the editor. Now you can post your review and within a second get a commenter from Rotten Tomatoes calling you fag.
You're right, Keith.
And it's like, you know, like for me, right now, my review of Brave, which I was not a fan of, has already garnered some comments on the website, on the Time Out website, calling me names and, you know, not really dealing with any of the substance of the piece. And like you say, I, if the cynicism grows out of anything, unfortunately, I think it's not the trolls. I think it's just, you know, it's us subjecting ourselves, we who love doing the writing.
Letting
subjecting
it get
ourselves,
to you.
Yeah, exactly. Subjecting ourselves to that and allowing it to poison you or poison ourselves. And I just feel like I don't think, you know, but at the same time, I don't want to be someone who says we must avoid or not go to certain sites. But I do think we need to learn what blocks to put on, like where not to go. For me, I'm getting to a point where once I've written a piece, I leave it as is. And
right.
I accept that people are going to react to it. But I don't really want to participate in a digital discussion of it.
Oh, God,
if someone would like to, you know, write me an email or talk to me, like if we were, you know, if you all wanted to talk about a review of mine or something on the show, I mean, that's different because
right.
then we're having a dialogue and there's an assumed, you know,
there's
some kind of general decorum, I think, that goes with that.
Right.
So I think, I just think the cynicism. I think the potential for cynicism was always there. It's just become more amplified now because the internet is an amplifier.
Yeah.
It amplifies the voices of the things. I don't even necessarily know if they're people because they could all be one, you know, terrible, evil little child in a basement somewhere, you know, or not even a basement. Maybe he's a very happy child except when he gets on the...
Again, outhouse in the backyard.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you don't know. You know, it's like you can see all these comments, and you can just like amplify in your own mind the whole world is against me, but the internet is not the whole world. You know,
thank
it's
God.
Not. It's a very minor part of the world.
Thank you.
You know, and it's just like and I just to bring it back to Harris because I think we should really end with him. That's, you know, why he will last, I think, is he was such a strong individual voice to the point that he didn't even need to argue, you know, with any trolls or whatever. He said his piece, he said it intelligently, he said it passionately, and he maintained that curiosity that he had about the art that he committed himself to till the end of his days. And that's what I want to emulate, and that's what I hope more people emulate, because that is what I see is missing a lot. You know, people just focus on the on what the trolls are throwing at them, and essentially, then I think go down to that level. And
right.
We need to rise above that. We need to be better than that. I think that Saritz was better than that, and I think you know, I just hope I can, you know, live up to his example in that way.
That's well said.
You're definitely on the right. I mean, you've definitely been doing that as long as I've known you. So.
Well, you know, I don't know if an artist is necessarily the best judge of his own work. So,
I'm just my own observation.
Yeah.
But if I can throw it back and just ask a very important question.
Yeah.
When did, and this goes back obviously long before any of us were online or anything, but when did it become so important to have this consensus in someone's favor? Why is that so important? We want people to agree with us on our opinions.
Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, and again, it's kind of like Rotten Tomatoes is great to a degree because it collects everybody in one place.
Right.
So, you know, you can click on certain reviews or just get a sense, oh, Mike D'Angelo didn't like that. Oh, Stephanie Zahara liked that. Oh, Andrew O'Hara liked that. You know, it's like you can just use it as like, oh, I know this person didn't like it. Let me go see what they have to say in more depth. Unfortunately, you know, the rotten and the red tomato and thing, and then I guess, you know, in to a degree, thumbs up and thumbs down as well, star ratings, you know, they all kind of built upon each other, and they're not necessarily bad things in and of themselves. It's just, again, the thumbs up, thumbs down worked for Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. Unfortunately, so many other people decided to take it as their own
thing
and bastardize it. And, you know, too many people take these things that work in a specific context. You know, I think this is like, you know, like someone like Bill Watterson never wanted Calvin and Hobbes to be animated because he said it would rob the strip of its soul. You know, so it's kind of like, it's, so many people take these things that really only work in one context, and then it gets bastardized and it kind of poisons, you know, what was good about the other thing. And hopefully all you can hope in that case, I mean, you know, when you lose control of your creation, is that you can still maintain the integrity that came with that, that came with the shorthand, I guess. You know, because, I mean, the star ratings, the thumbs up, thumbs down, they're shorthand. They're shorthand to say, I like this, I didn't like it. And, you know, that's fine to a degree, but more, you got to go more in depth. This behooves the critics, this behooves the viewers, this behooves, you know, every human on this earth. Is we should strive always to go more in depth on things, to be, you know, to be critical thinkers about things. And unfortunately, you know, it's just much easier for people to say thumbs up, thumbs down, and that's it, you know, and leave it
at
that.
And then they look at the percentile, you know, oh, 78%, you know, fresh as opposed to, you know, whatever. It's all like a numbers game. I always kind of like it, all that stuff.
It's a Consumer Reports, all. It's like Consumer Reports, unfortunately, and that's,
well, that's a bad thing at the end of the day. Well, I kind of liken it to, like, sports fans, like, saying, well, this year so-and-so is batting, you know, this average, but last year he batted this average, that kind of thing. And it's that same kind of, I think movies kind of engender music can, too, that same sort of fandom where it's like, okay, I'm on this movie's team. I'm on this director's team. I'm on this studio's team, and I want them to win. And the numbers don't lie, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But you're not looking, as Keith is saying, you're not looking into the details.
The details are very important.
It should be pointed out too, I think, that Sarah's actually, his method was inspired by his love of sports, I believe. You know, he was using a kind of sports judging system in the American cinema, you know, and that was radical and new at the time to kind of group people like that, and very helpful. But again, I think the reason it worked for him was because he was not positing it as the be-all, end-all, just a way, you know. I'd like to see more people get back to saying, this is a way to look at something. Not the way.
Exactly.
A way.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's it, I guess.
Keith, my friend, thank you so much. And you are actually going to join us again in a couple of weeks when we do our Summer of 87 roundtable, tentatively scheduled for us for July 18th, which I think is a Wednesday. But you guys will start running 80s pieces on The House Next Door second week of July, or...?
The deadline that I've given people is July 9th for articles, and then I believe I'm going to get a nice, healthy supply that I can then sort of parcel out either on a daily, every other day, whatever. We'll see how much I get, and we'll just go with that. For the rest
of
the summer.
And we'll certainly push that series. And actually, I mean, that's one of our favorite shows every year, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it should be.
I can't wait to talk to you about Over the Top. All right,
and
my friend. I appreciate it. I look forward to talking to you again in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Yeah. Have a good night, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Bye, Keith. Bye-bye. Okay, that's Keith Ulick. You can read his criticism at Time Out New York. That's where he does his film reviews. Okay. Some other things have happened in movie news outside of Mr. Saris's passing. And we'll get to those in a second. But we have an interview that we have to get to.
Right.
Big Miracle. It's a film starring Drew Barrymore and Ted Danson and John Krasinski, and it's got a great cast. It's a great family film about three whales that got trapped in ice and the kind of the international movement to save them. And it's directed by Ken Kwapis. You might remember. He's the director of the big hit. He's just not that into you. And this is a little bit of a change of pace for him. And we talked to him about Big Miracle, which is now on DVD and Blu-ray. It came out yesterday. And he actually knew Movie Geeks United. He was like, I know your show very well. I'm honored to be on it. So, I automatically, you know, I really kiss up to the host, you know.
He's also been instrumental. He directed a lot of episodes, I know, and won a few Emmys, I think, at least one Emmy, for directing the Larry Sanders Show.
Oh, God, I missed that show. Wow.
What a great show that
is.
But I think he directed the last episode, Flip, and won an Emmy for that. But at any rate, he directed a lot of episodes of that.
I just revisited a lot of Larry Sanders, like in the past year. I went back and watched pretty much that whole series. He did do 12 episodes of it. The Larry Sanders
and he's
Show,
done,
yeah.
I think he's done some, he might have even done some Curb Your Enthusiasm. I'm not sure about that. But.
Yeah. So here is Mr. Quapis talking about Big Miracle. You can purchase it right here from our website. And I highly recommend it. Here he is.
The avocado. This little guy and pretty much everything else in town has to take four separate plane rides to arrive up here in Chili Barrow, Alaska.
Adam. Your material up there seems like it's running a little thin.
What the heck?
I think Barrow might have one great story left in her.
This is solid ice. It goes for 5 miles from here to the open ocean.
Three gray whales are now trapped in walls of ice 6 inches thick.
You have whales in trouble and you didn't call me?
I didn't call you because there's nothing you can do.
There's always something you can do.
Rachel, I'd like you to meet Fred and Wilma. And this is Bam Bam.
Everything's gonna be okay. Governor Haskell, we were wondering if you could mobilize a ship that can break through the ice.
You're serious?
With every passing hour, their path to freedom slips further away as more of the ocean turns solid.
All we need is the cooperation from the governor, but the governor has basically turned his back on the whales.
I hate her so much.
We will do everything we can
to help these poor creatures.
Pretty amazing, huh?
Were you aware of this story as it was happening, or were you introduced to it through the script? How did this come about?
I remember it, but not very well. And the reason I remember it was taking place right during the tail end of the George Bush, Michael Dukakis presidential campaign in the fall of 1988. And I do remember that it's because I followed the campaign very closely, and I do remember watching primetime news, and occasionally there'd be an article or a piece about some trapped whales. So I kind of remember it, but I certainly didn't remember any of the details about it.
Well, this feels like a very like a passion project. It feels like a lot of passion went into this film, and I'm curious to know, when you read the material, what about it made you say, I have to make this movie?
Here's what I fell in love with. I fell in love with the idea of a story about a group of people, most of whom have different philosophies, in many cases competing agendas, ulterior motives, strange bedfellows, in other words. A group of strange bedfellows who would normally not be caught, you know, having a drink together, who have to come together and figure out a way to solve an impossible task. That really appealed to me. The picture I did right before Big Miracle was a romantic-themed film, He's Just Not That Into You, and that was a film that had 9 major characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
But in that film, that was a different kind of film in the sense that there was a theme, and the theme was explored in different stories. Most of the stories did not overlap. In this case, this is more of a true ensemble about a group of people trying to accomplish something together. But what I loved is how different those characters were, and again, how opposed they were philosophically.
Well, that's what amazes me most about the film, I think, is because it started out as a small story, and then it kind of grew it kind of had international ramifications. But you never, juggling all those characters, and you never lose sight of the humanity and the plight of these whales. Was that the main challenge of the film for you?
Oh, absolutely. The thing is, at the center of both the media circus that descended upon Barrow, but also at the center of all the efforts on the part of these characters are three characters, the three main characters, the three gray whales. And as Drew Barrymore puts it wonderfully in a scene, she says the most heartbreaking thing about their plight is that they know they're in trouble. They know they're in trouble. Mm. And I'm certainly not a scientist. I'm certainly not an expert on animals. But, you know, in doing research for the project, I certainly came to learn that whales have as advanced an intellect as any animals out there. And so I love the idea that, you know, the three creatures have a real consciousness about the dilemma they face. And I think that's what makes them so, you know, that makes the trio so powerful. It's also a family. So the other part of it is it's a story about a trapped family. And so I think that, you know, even though there's all these other events swirling around them, and there are so many layers to the picture, not only is the story set against the backdrop of a presidential campaign in America, but it's also set against the backdrop of there's a geopolitical backdrop. It's the tail end of the Cold War, yeah. And so despite, I don't want to say despite, but, you know, even with all this sort of swirling activity around them, the heart of the picture remains these three whales that, you know, are in this like rather gruesome dilemma.
Well, staying on that, well, talking about the layers, as you are, of this piece, and going on to kind of the process of putting it all together, did you find that there was a lot of shaping and rearranging going on in the editing room to have it all kind of fit seamlessly together?
Oh, absolutely. And again, because there were so many different attempts happening simultaneously, you know, part of the challenge in cutting the picture together was whose attempt, you know, should get the focus and when. Whether it was the Dermot Mulroney character, you know, taking two of those immense helicopters, sky cranes, and dragging this hover barge across the Arctic sea ice, or whether it was the Inupiat people, led by the whale hunter Malik, who came up with what seemed like an insane plan to carve a series of holes in the ice with no real hope that the whales would move from hole to hole. So in editing the picture, it was like, what, you know, finding the right order for these things to happen. Let's put it this way. It was definitely something we discovered in the cutting of the
mm-hmm.
picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is such a dramatic story. In and of itself, I wouldn't think it would need any kind of extra flourishes with your filming it necessarily, dramatic license or anything. But did you feel a kind of responsibility to the real-life counterparts as part of the story?
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, again, like some of the real-life counterparts were helpful in putting together the film. I felt a particular responsibility to the Inuit people, who are the Native Alaskan people who occupy the what's called the North Slope of the state, the northern end of the state. And, you know, I tried very hard in depicting them, not to patronize them or romanticize them, but to you know, make you get to know them as you would any other characters. So I did feel a kind of a keen responsibility to them as a group. And but I definitely felt like this is a film that, as you said, you don't need to embellish it too much. It's all there. And one of the things you should know is that not only is it all there, there were about 150 reporters who descended.
Wow.
Upon the town of Barrow in the fall of 1988. Again, as soon as Tom Brokaw fell in love with those first set of images and agreed to put a piece on NBC Nightly News about the whales, the trapped whales, literally within 24 hours, every news service in the country and across the world sent people to Barrow. So there were about 150 people there, most of them armed with video cameras. And this is in the beta age, by the way. But so there's a mountain of footage that these people took of the rescue. And one of the things we did is we had access to all of this footage, combed through it, and used a lot of it in the film. So when you're watching the film, when you see the whales, occasionally you're seeing the whales that we created. We built large animatronic whales. At other times, you're seeing whales that were created through computer-generated imagery. Those are the shots underwater. But many times, particularly when you're looking at a television monitor, you'll see interspersed with the whales we created, the actual whales from footage taken in 1988. Mm. And it was our goal to replicate the real whales as perfectly as we could.
Absolutely. And you guys did a great job on that. But there's also the character of, and you touched upon it there, the location itself. What was it like being in that environment and having that play a role in the film?
Well, two things you should know. One is the story is set primarily in the town of Barrow, Alaska, which is about 250 miles north of the Arctic Circle, and it is the most northern town in our hemisphere, period. So that's where the story is set. We certainly had a small unit shooting in Barrow, but most of our work was done in Anchorage. Doesn't mean it wasn't cold, but it wasn't as far north as Barrow itself. So we shot in Anchorage. We shot in the fall heading towards winter because we did want the cold. We wanted snow, and we got it. And it was cold. And so among the many things that made this such a physically daunting picture for me was it was intensely cold. And as we got into the fall, we in Alaska, you're losing daylight at a rate of about a minute and a half a day. So we had short hours. We had these large animatronic whales. We had to build an ice field set. So the Arctic sea ice that's frozen was a set, a huge set, a football field size set. And in the middle of the set, we built an underground water tank in order to house the three animatronic whales. Now, occasionally the whales would break, and in order to fix them, we would have to send divers down into the tank, into very cold water to do very complicated repairs on animatronic animals.
Wow.
So it was complicated. And then add to that a large ensemble, some of whom were actors who'd never been in front of a camera before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the man who played the whale hunter Malik and the boy Amau were new to movies.
Wow.
New to movies, cast in Alaska. And so it was a logistically pretty complicated picture.
I bet it was. Before I let you go, I have to ask you about this because we just did a big series on cinematography, and it's something mm-hmm. that fascinates us on the show. And with this one and a couple of your other films, you're working with one of the best, John Bailey. What is the dynamic between the two of you, the conversations that go on when you're building the look of a film?
You know, it's funny, in this case, each of the films we've done several films together, but in this one we really wanted... We had a very strong idea, and it's simple, and let me explain it. We wanted the audience to feel like we were capturing the action as opposed to staging it for the camera. Now, that may seem like a subtle distinction, but we wanted to, as much as possible, shy away from things that felt overly choreographed, and especially out on the ice itself. We wanted to feel more like things were happening and we were able to grab it or capture it. That's not to say we were veering into mockumentary land at all.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything, I would say that we were thinking about literally like Italian neorealism and the way the films of, say, the Rossellini films after the Second World War were photographed – where you just got a sense that the camera was there to eavesdrop on the action, as opposed to in other kinds of films where things are, again, staged so precisely for the lens, or where compositions feel overly manicured and precious. So
right.
that was our guiding principle. I mean, whether or not we achieved it, I that's for someone else to say, but that was kind of how we went into it.
The National Guard will pull the icebreaker where it's desperately needed.
The pole should be a piece of cake.
Nothing's that simple in the Arctic.
This is a monumental task, as all eyes and efforts are focused on saving the whale.
Temperature has dropped through the floor. We can't keep up with the ice.
The town of Barrow has shut down, as school children and shopkeepers alike furiously work to cut a path to the ocean.
Where's Bam Bam? He's not coming up.
Maybe he's hurt.
You can't go down there. It's too dangerous.
Within navigable distance belongs to the Soviets.
I'll be damned if I'm going to let the Reds in to save the day.
Then those whales are going to die. Even though they're big and powerful. They're so much like us. We're vulnerable. We get scared. We need help sometimes, too.
Okay, that was director Ken Kwapis. His film is Big Miracle, now available on DVD and Blu-ray. Purchase it right here from our show page or go to our website, moviegeeksunited.net/media, and you can purchase it from there as well. All right, guys, movie news.
I have a question. I have a news thing. So yesterday, a fourth trailer for The Dark Knight Rises, and I just have one question to ask. Really?
Really trailered out on that thing.
I mean, I want to see it, don't get me wrong.
Just see it already.
One trailer. You don't even need a trailer. Everyone wants to see it. You don't need...
Why are they doing that?
I don't know.
It.
I think... This is my thing, though. It's a recycled... I mean, when you have four trailers, the chances are it's going to have... One of them is going to have to be recycled footage. And this one definitely... Is this thing about... Four trailers for this? I could understand if this was a movie no one had ever heard of, with not big name actors or anything, and not based on a popular character for the last century or so. But really, four trailers for The Dark Knight Rises?
I don't know. I don't know if they feel endangered by or threatened by the Avengers. I don't know if they feel competition.
I think it's a different beast, but. The interesting thing about the Avengers is that there's this director's cut that I guess is going to come out later this summer.
Yeah, they're trying to catch up to Cameron's first and second spot. You know what? But even if it were a Harry Potter or a romantic comedy, if a movie opened up the month before they come out and it became the third biggest movie of all time, they would feel competitive with it. So
I'm sure they would. And I mean, it has every right to, in one sense, because. I mean, there is no such thing as a sure thing. I would have ventured the Avengers would have done well, but not this well. That's surprising. I think that's really surprising. Remember, film of all time.
Is it up to being the third biggest film of all time now?
Yes.
Not adjusted for inflation, but just by today's dollars.
No. I mean, Avatar and Titanic aren't the biggest of all time adjusted for inflation. And I think
true. Adjusted for inflation,
it's still Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind, it's still number one.
That's what I just said.
Avatar and...
I said not even Avatar and Titanic are the biggest of all time when adjusted for inflation.
But I guess my point is this. I remember, the summer of 83, and they're still showing ads on TV. This is like a month or 2 months after Return of the Jedi came out. My brother's like, do people really need to know that it's still playing? It's going to play all summer. It's going to make a lot of
that
money.
That was when movies lasted, too. I mean,
But
we're always used to seeing, I mean, they always like come out with, for big movies, they come out with multiple kind of versions of TV commercials.
Well,
but the thing about A Dark Knight Rises, they release all those TV spots online, and people click them, and then you have four different theatrical trailers, and each of them kind of has a different music score, and they want to express a different aspect of the movie. So the aspect of this movie, they said was Batman is angry. That was like the theme of the fourth one.
Isn't he always angry?
He's not that joyous Batman.
The trailer before this, though, you get the feeling that he's a, you know, because in this one he says, I'm not scared, I'm angry. And in the last trailer, it's very ominous that, like, oh shit, he might not make it. You know?
Yeah, and I don't think he will. I had another conversation the other night with our friend Patrick, a great friend of mine, a great friend of the show. But he was like, he's been showing his children the Batman movies. I think he showed him Batman Begins, and he said, you know, to his kid, he was like, you know, Jamie thinks Batman's going to die in the next one.
That's great. Like, positive influence.
I can imagine it was almost like I killed Santa Claus or something, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, but it caught me, really. We have four trailers. We got less than a month. I mean, exactly a month ago. I mean, it just seems like one of those things. If there is a sure thing this year.
Yeah. There's the definite balance between generating I gotta see it factor with, you know, enough already. Building a buzz and then killing it.
They did this also to a lesser extent with the last one, though, too. I mean, but not as – I mean, I guess it's because this is it. This is the last Nolan one, at least. So, yeah, we got to go all out.
Yeah, but you know they'll reboot it. I mean, they're already talking about rebooting Twilight. They are, yeah.
Oh,
but hopefully with, like, Zach Galifianakis and Lisa Lampanelli in the
perfect.
Lead.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. There's a lot of blood to suck in those bodies. Yeah. Richard Lynch, character actor, he passed away. It was announced late last night.
That's right.
When I think of Richard Lynch, whether it's fair or not, I think of two movies, one of which was his first movie, which was Scarecrow. He was the one that raped and beat up Al Pacino in prison.
Okay,
I mean,
wow.
What a way to start your career right there. I mean, come on.
Yeah. I mean,
and then the other movie I think of is Invasion USA.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I've seen both of these. Okay.
Oh, come on. 80s cheese? You cannot get better than
Invasion USA.
USA.
That scene where they blow up all the houses in the neighborhood, you know, with the rocket launcher? Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Little Nikita, he was in that.
Oh.
Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
The Ninth Configuration.
Jamie, I've seen all of these. This is very frightening.
Wow.
The
Sword and Sorcerer.
I mean.
Yeah.
Now what, Dean?
Was Little Nikita the thing with River Phoenix?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's
right.
Yeah. Okay.
And Sidney Poitier.
Right.
Anyway,
Susan Terrell passed away,
yeah,
too.
Susan Terrell from Fat City, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
God, and another great cult movie actress.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on from death to resurrection. I try to make any segue I possibly can for this piece of movie news.
Okay.
Kenneth Lonergan's movie Margaret. I mean, that was a real bumpy ride, years in the making to just get to like two or three screens. But one of the biggest critically acclaimed films of last year, just nobody got to see it. The director's cut releases in 3 weeks on Blu-ray.
I will definitely
rent it. Incredibly excited
about
that.
See it. I mean, I figured I'd wait for that.
That's one of those rare movies that I'm like, I'm going to buy it immediately without even having seen it, because I'm going to buy it. I think it's going to be fantastic.
The Daily Beast came out with their best movies of 2012 so far.
Yeah, tell us what those are. I was very curious. I didn't bother clicking on it. Tell me.
Some of which have not come our way yet. Beasts of the Southern Wild. It was a big Sundance hit. It won some awards.
July. coming up.
June 27th, limited.
That's pretty much, you know, garnering the sort of winter's bone spot in the, you know, in the year end.
I think you're right.
Thing.
You're absolutely right.
And you know, the lead girl in it, who was, I think, six at the time, and I can't pronounce her name, so don't ask me, but she was, I think, six when they filmed it, so she's eight now. And but she'll be, you know, if she gets up there, she'll be the youngest, you know, person to be nominated for an Oscar. Yeah.
Could be.
But
could
they're
be.
Already talking about that. So
this is not a film, which is a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
He was arrested. The filmmaker was arrested in March of 2010 for making this movie. They said it was for creating propaganda against the Iranian government.
Mm.
Sentenced
to, takes place all in his apartment, right?
Sentenced to 6 years in prison and a 20-year filmmaking ban.
Wow.
Fascinating glimpse into the life of an Iranian enemy of the state. It was this is the movie that was smuggled from Iran
mm-hmm.
to Cannes Film Festival
mm-hmm.
inside
right.
a flash drive. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I just missed seeing it at the New York Film Festival. But it did play last year at the New York Film Festival.
I mean, this is one of those stories where you really think, thank God we live in the U.S.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, absolutely.
We complain
we
here and there
that.
About, you know.
We forget that because their revolution failed that they had after that election. We forget that, you know, it is hard. I mean, while there's a lot of great films that have come out of there in the last 20
mm-hmm.
years, but we forget it is a dictatorship. We forget that sometimes. But this is a stark reminder about that.
Yeah. Bernie is among their best films of 2012 so far.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I mean, sure, why not?
I can't say
it was the best.
It doesn't seem to be playing anywhere around Atlanta.
I'm surprised. I thought that would be Atlanta's a big market. I thought it would be there.
I mean, it's playing here in Tampa.
But sometimes things like blow in here and blow out like in a week.
I know.
Like,
that happens here too.
I dated a girl from Atlanta that did that.
Margaret made it here to the Terra Cinema here, but literally was only here for a week.
Yeah. So. Movie called Elena.
That came Russian. And went here for a week too.
Russian film.
I don't know anything about that one.
What is that Kate Nelligan movie? Is that also called Elena? From the 80s?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Your Sister's Sister, one of
that
the top
good.
Of the year.
That was a good movie. I like that movie.
That's a Lynn Shelton movie.
Yeah, it is. That's all I kept saying during the movie. Hey, we interviewed her.
Did we really? We
yeah,
did.
Yeah, we did.
Now, what is that? What is that?
Hump Day. You're right.
Jamie. Oh, my God. All right. Now you're as bad as my mom.
Dude, I've talked to 600 people. I lose track.
And it's all
it's
over
good.
The phone.
It's got every man in it. Mark Duplass is just in everything now. Like, Safety Not Guaranteed, Darling Companion. And
the Catherine Bigelow movie. He's in that.
Yeah, he's in everything.
I mean, that's garnering a whole... shitstorm of controversy in itself, and that doesn't come out until December, and that's generating controversy because this is about the decade or more hunt for Bin Laden, or you know how Clinton went after him and just missed him, and then how it kind of carried over from presidency to presidency.
Right.
So it spans a big amount of time. This is Catherine Bigelow's next movie, and obviously it comes out in December, so it's they won awards consideration for it, but it's receiving controversy. Because they consulted the government about the content of the movie, and they're talking about did they divulge secretive stuff? I mean, they even say that they talked to the leader of the group that went in to kill Bin Laden.
Right. It's this whole thing the last couple of weeks between that and the other leaks that are coming out. It just doesn't bode well for anybody. I mean, this David Sanger book that you know, just tons of stuff that. You know, someone called, I think it was Peggy Noonan called, but whoever is in charge is a chatty Kathy. I mean, so It's just, it's amazing that we would not think of that, you know, like 20, 30 years ago, if this guy, you know, him would have been like eager to share any of this stuff. And it's just weird that all of a sudden it's like, boom, everyone's talking. It's so weird. But
yeah.
That's December 2?
Yes.
Yeah.
Why? Oh, just this. Why the hell with it? The Dark Knight. Everything should just be pushed back to December.
There's also this. There's also this. Weinstein just bought a movie about the killing of Bin Laden, and he's trying to preempt the Bigelow picture with it.
Oh God. Well, this should make for an exciting sideline story. I mean,
yeah. Another one of their best movies of 2012. Zero, I guess. Our hero, Dreams of Sushi.
Yeah, everyone's raving.
Oh, yeah.
I want to see that. I definitely want to see that.
Chronicles Ono's quest to create the perfect piece of sushi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for it.
And it's a documentary, right?
Yeah, it's a documentary,
which,
yeah.
Dear
yeah.
God, I hope so. I mean, I've been waiting for a movie to deal with that subject.
I know. I get the enthusiasm in your voice, Jamie. It's just...
Any movie involving fish, I'm on board, especially if it's a documentary. The Amazing Spider-Man is on their list.
Yeah, so they've seen this. So unlike Sony, they like the movie. Okay.
Yeah. European critics have seen it because it's released. It's been. It's premiered overseas. I think it's actually released there on Friday, or maybe already it's released. Maybe released there today.
Maybe,
I think
okay.
That's one of those movies they're getting earlier than we are.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's kind of the perk that they get for having bad teeth.
So, well, they have that, and also just because everything's going down the tubes there, so we'll give them Spider-Man, throw them a bone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten largely mixed reviews, but there have been some positives about it. I mean, no one's really taken massive offense to it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if there's anything that can be said, it's just that it just seems so soon to do a reboot. It just seems so utterly. They just seems like they started in 2002, 10 years ago with it, and to go ahead and reboot it after just like what was it like 8 years just was like kind of seems silly. But we'll see. Maybe it's good.
The Cabin in the Woods is on their list.
Oh, good for them. Great movie.
So that's three people. Okay. Dean and the Daily Beast.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I love that movie. Fantastic.
Yeah. All right. And the documentary Undefeated is on their list. I never got to see that.
No, I never got to see that either.
That was the best documentary winner last year.
Yeah, it was the only one of the five that I hadn't seen up to the award.
Surprise. I mean, I thought it was a surprise win, but then, you know, then I thought, well, why did I think that? Weinstein owns it, you know. and finally, and this is a great segue into our closing interview tonight, actually. I did expect that. Their final best movie of 2012 so far, 21 Jump Street.
Oh, huh. Okay.
I would throw that. I would also throw The Gray and Moonrise Kingdom in there, but that's just me.
Because I
would put in Once Upon a Time in Anatolia and Kid on the Bike.
I'd love to. Yeah, I want to see those. Yeah, definitely.
And Haywire.
Oh, yeah, definitely Haywire, yeah.
And Rock of Ages. And Rock of Ages, too.
Zero Dreams of Sushi and Rock of Ages side by side.
That's a double feature for you.
Yeah. Yeah, 21 Jump Street. We're about to play our interview with the director of 21 Jump Street. He's among the filmmakers that are in this conversation. I like 21 Jump Street. That's probably the most I've laughed so far this year.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you see the Paul Thomas Anderson trailer?
Yes.
The Master.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is October? Please tell me it's not December. Please tell me it's October.
I think it's October.
No, it is
yeah.
October.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Okay, let's see. Okay. Thank God. All right.
Now, that's a movie that becomes, it's almost the opposite of The Dark Knight. It becomes more intriguing, these few trailers we've seen of it.
Mm-hmm.
within 2 weeks' time, you know. But do you think it's going to be controversial?
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, they tried to shut it down, and, I mean, Megan Olsen saved the day, and then, I mean...
But I guess I should refine my question, because controversial within, you know, the upper rankings of Scientology, yeah. But does that matter to Joe Somebody?
No, I mean, it doesn't matter to Joe Somebody.
But I do think that there's a large percentage of the population, you know, that has very much a lot of curiosity about that religion and what goes on in it.
It could be really amazing. But Tom Cruise has seen it. He objects to some content in it. And
of course.
I guess he's still going to show it to Travolta, but I don't think
I don't
any
really
of those
think
opinions.
Travolta can say anything right now, but he probably just asked, can the guy, where's your masseuse?
He's been on the promotional front for Savages. He's been
good
doing
for him.
Interviews and stuff.
I look forward to, I really want to see that.
Yeah. They said, hey, you want to do some interviews for Savages? And he says, aye, where's the rub? Anyway. Yeah. Hey, we'll be back Sunday with Virginia Madsen. Sorry.
Ooh, Madsen, yeah.
What is
yeah.
she? What is, so you've interviewed the brother, and now you've interviewed the sister. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She
what
was
is she
nice.
On for? What is she what is she promoting?
She was very friendly. Her movie's called The Magic of Belle Isle. And I watched this thing last night.
It's on demand, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really lovely, delicate, sentimental movie. I mean, I really fell in love with it. It's she and Morgan Freeman. It's directed by Rob Reiner. It's a good film. So it's now available on demand. She'll be on Sunday to talk about it.
Awesome.
And then, yeah.
When are we doing the sequels show?
Sequels?
Yeah.
All movies that deserve
sequels. Where we posit our movies that deserve sequels.
Okay, we'll make that.
I did a lot of research. I actually want to watch the film on VHS. I hooked up the VHS to work on this show.
Yeah, we do need to do that.
I've been working on my list pretty steadily.
I haven't been doing anything for it. But the show right before our July 1st, our William Friedkin show, that would be the 28th, Wednesday the 28th.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a week from tonight. I mean,
the 27th. Okay, we'll do it. We'll do it then.
Yeah,
sounds
I mean,
good.
I was going to do it. I keep coming up with these, so I was just going to do it like once a week. I'd name a movie or something.
Yeah. And maybe if the show's really
fun.
Good, maybe if the show's really good, maybe we'll consider doing a sequel to it. Was this sequel or remake?
Sequel. It was because I opened my big bloody mouth about Five Easy Pieces. That's why this all came about. And do you know where it comes from? Do you know where this whole idea came from? A Siskel and Ebert's review of The Godfather Part 3, where they said it's just really good to see these characters again. That's where this all came from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's where this all came from. That's just I just want that on the record. So in case anyone wants to throw something at my house, they can.
Was it good
I'm
to see
sure
those characters
line.
Again
I'm,
in the Texas?
I'm sure the line will be repeating ad nauseum next week.
I'm going to shut up next week about that. But that's where this all came from, though, because I was like, oh, yeah, you're right, guys. It really is. It's great.
I'm wondering, though, if Siskel and Ebert actually repeated their mantra when they when they reviewed Texasville.
Yeah, you know, see these characters went to make Dwayne's depressed. So,
Bogdanovich just signed on for a new movie.
What movie?
You would ask.
Yes, I would.
It's something starring Tom Sizemore. It's about porn king or something, I think.
Wow. Okay.
Lots of people like exploring the world of porn, in one fashion or another.
And no one did it better than P.T. Anderson in Boogie Nights.
Right. I mean, Bogdanovich isn't the first person I think of when I think porn, but even though Bogdanovich does sound like a nickname for something you do to your partner in bed.
Hey, I'm going to Bogdanovich you.
And he was married to Dorothy Stratton, don't forget.
Right.
And is now married to her sister. So
I'm so proud of that joke. But Paul Schrader and Bret Easton Ellis just cast a porn actor opposite Lindsay Lohan.
This is the Canyons, right?
Yeah, the Canyons. And I think Lindsay Lohan's playing the Canyon. I'm not sure.
This is a movie, I think these guys were meant to work with each other. They were meant to work with each other. That's going to be a crazy set. The two of them, oh my God.
It's going to be good.
I'm looking forward to it.
Financed in part by Kickstarter. I mean, they were successful. I think they raised something like $150,000 or something. So it's be an interesting production. And Paul Schrader, even years ago when we talked to him, he was very open to, you know.
He had a cell phone.
Redefine what films are, you know.
Yeah.
So Paul Schrader, Bret Easton Ellis, Peter Bogdanovich, I think that's what his movie's about. I'm not absolutely certain, though. And then Octomom, I mean, it's all over the place.
And then you have the two competing the Linda Lovelace movies, too.
Oh, right. Yes.
What was that movie that came out last year that was also about the beginning of the internet porn industry?
It's with Luke Wilson. It's actually a very entertaining movie, but
Company Men or not Company
Men? Yes, I think it is Company Men. Company Men
is Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
No, that's Kevin Costner. That's the after effect. You stay home and watch porn because you can't get a job.
It's Something Men.
Middlemen.
Okay.
Middlemen, yeah. Okay.
That's a very entertaining movie, yeah.
Cool. All right. So we'll be back Sunday night. Then we go from porn to our final interview.
There's your segue.
Yeah, I know. The segue was so beautiful. The movie Pincus premieres... It actually premiered Saturday night at the Los Angeles Film Festival. It shows again tomorrow evening. It's directed by David Finster. It stars David Nordstrom, and it's executive produced by Phil Lord, who was one of the co-directors of 21 Jump Street this year. And it's a great, interesting, fascinating hybrid of a film between narrative, kind of a spiritual meditative journey mixed in with a documentary featuring the director's father who suffers from Parkinson's, and it's an interesting film. And we have all three in this interview segment talking about the film, which shows tomorrow night at the LA Film Festival. Okay, guys. So thank you both.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoyable, invigorating conversation.
Yeah, we ended up. Never mind. I'm not going to go back to it.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
See you later.
Let's set it up real quick for me. This came from kind of an event or something that you're going through in your own life.
It was, you know, my father's had Parkinson's now for like 13 plus years. And about 4 years ago, I hadn't lived in Miami since college, so, and I'm in my mid-30s now, so I hadn't lived in Miami in a really long time, and I moved back for a year to kind of help him and my mom out, because they don't have any other children, and she was having a really hard time taking care of him by herself, and his disease was just getting a lot worse. So I lived there about 4 years ago, and then I moved back again about a year and a half ago for a year. And the last time I was there, I just started shooting a video of my dad and recording audio. And I would do these kind of informal interviews we'd just basically have conversations and I'd record them. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what I was going to use those for, but they were good conversations and they kind of got us to places I don't think we would have got on our own. So I had no idea what I was going to do with that stuff, and I was trying to write this script about kind of a new age vision quest that wasn't going anywhere really, or it lacked certain ingredients. So I thought it would be interesting to have my dad actually be in the film and try to use some of the footage we've been recording and weave it into the actual film. And I thought having situation where his son sort of was forced to take care of his dad might actually make the sort of vision quest thing that I was going for a little bit, it would make more sense that way in that context and kind of hopefully be a little bit more engaging in that way. So that's kind of how it came about.
And Mr. Nordstrom, what did you respond to in all in that material and in the role of Pincus in particular?
Well, you know, I have to say, Dave will probably agree with me. It was really organic just because we had worked together on Dave's first film while we were still students at CalArts. And that also has some kind of like mystic element to it and kind of met during that project. Then we made this short film that played around various places and as part of Mike Plant's Lunch film series. And that one also had this sort of mystical subject matter about our personal experiences with strange kind of inexplicable events. And so we were always talking about that kind of stuff and sharing literature about it. I mean, what else, Dave, that we would send each other articles. And then when Dave started working on this script, he would be different versions. And we kind of just would spitball back and forth. And then playing the part was, in a sense, I mean, I'm more or less kind of a surrogate for Dave. Actually, you know, being in his house where he grew up and acting with his dad, and so that helped kind of just ground you into the role. There's really no risk of kind of losing sight of what the movie was about. So,
well, that sounds like I mean, being David's kind of surrogate in the film, that sounds like it must have been a very kind of personal, intimate filmmaking experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I was in Miami a little bit before we started shooting, but we pretty much had it hit the ground running, and I was just there in the mix of the family. And, you know, one of the caretakers that her father had at the time was in the movie, too, and so I was relating. And Dave's real mom was in the movie, too. I don't know if she's in... Are these people in the new cut, Dave?
Yeah.
Mom and... Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, and actually, yeah, everyone was pretty much more or less playing themselves but me. So that was interesting.
So Mr. Lord, tell me, you've worked with David before, but what made you excited about being a part of this particular project?
Well, Dave and I are childhood friends. I've known Dave and his family, you know, since I was a little kid. And I was just always sort of on the periphery of watching Dave and Dave Nordstrom also go through CalArts together and get to dabble in a kind of filmmaking that that I don't get to work in at all. So I'm mostly just jealous of those guys. David sometimes stays with me when he's in Los Angeles, and I just thought that I could see him sort of operating in this way, investigating these kinds of questions, and also I knew intimately what was going on with his dad, and I thought that it was really important for David to make a film about father and about the experiences, and if I could help in any way, that's what I wanted to do. I have to say that I really was only peripherally involved in this, but to the extent I was, it was probably the most enjoyable filmmaking experience that I've ever had, in part because I could just give notes and thoughts and had no responsibility for actually solving the problem. which is pretty fun. But to me, it was a little... I feel really grateful that these two guys, who I really respect both deeply as filmmakers, were willing to let me hang out nearby while it was happening.
Well, I mean, this is a big change of pace for a project that you're involved in. I mean, I have to tell you, I adore 21 Jump Street. I don't think I've laughed that much in a long, long time at a movie. But so what were you, when you say that you kind of were there along the way here and there and giving notes and that sort of thing, what was your contribution in terms of shaping the film at all or the direction it was going?
I mean, it's these guys' movie and it's Dave's movie. And I literally, what I said to Dave is, I am here as a resource that, you know, be useful and not to be a hindrance in any way. So it was literally just, you know, we went on a little writer's retreat. I was writing another movie at the time, and we went together to Crested Butte, Colorado, and, like, rented a house and hung out, and he would read my pages on the you know, the Lego movie that I was writing. I would give feedback on his incredibly deep art film that he was working on. And the same as how Dave Nordstrom was describing, you know, a lot of our collaboration started with talking about things and going on hikes and talking about things we were curious about. And I've learned a lot from both Daves in that way, and sort of with a kind of natural outgrowth of sitting around the house and talking about movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a very kind of, I mean, it's its own kind of entity. I mean, it's part documentary, and it's feeling, and it's very personal. And did it feel like, I mean, did it feel kind of experimental in a way where you guys weren't sure whether or not it was working, or was it always obvious when you were hitting it out of the park?
I'm curious to hear what those guys have to say, and it'd be cool if they were honest about it. I had a ton of doubt surrounding this project, and I never felt like, I mean, there'd be days where we'd shoot and Dave would be in a scene with Dietmar or somebody, and I'd be like, oh, that's amazing, whatever just happened in front of the camera. But as a whole, I never was sure the thing was going to, like, fit together and make sense and feel like anything. And there were just plenty of moments throughout the whole thing where I was a little worried about what I was sort of dragging my friends and family through, and if it was going to be meaningful in any way. So yeah, I don't, that sense of hitting it out of the park, I don't know if I ever had that any time in the process, but sure, there were really exciting moments to the process, but there, I have to say, I had a lot of doubt about my own work in general, but in this project in particular, because it was so personal, there was a lot of moments of not being sure if it's going to all come together in the end.
Yeah. Well, I think that kind of...
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to add on that any doubts that I would normally have were kind of expelled just by the working situation, which again, was really unique, in which, you know, I didn't have to worry about a lot of typical things you worry about when you're acting, because a lot of what I was doing was, you know, working with his dad in a real environment, whether we were going to the wildlife park or going to on an outing. Like, so much of it was about actually making sure that he was getting around and getting what he needed and wasn't hurting himself, and also trying to communicate plot points and kind of notes and topics in the scene we were supposed to hit, because his dad actually would do a great job, but he would kind of get exhausted, I think, from take to take, and we kind of stop and take a rest and go back at it. So I was, it's exactly what you're supposed to be doing when you're acting. You're actually really interacting with the person in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really have time to really worry about stuff. I let Dave do all the worrying. He does it well.
I don't know. I guess I've met filmmakers that, like, feel like they just finished a day of shooting and felt like they knocked it out of the park. But I certainly don't operate that way in the work that I do, and I don't really know anybody who does.
Right.
And I just think you there's so much to worry about. I've talked to other filmmakers who just feel like that's the whole job.
is like knowing what to worry about the whole time. I have to say that, you know, watching stuff from, you know, I was these guys were shooting in Miami and I was in Los Angeles and New Orleans, and just getting to see cuts every once in a while and read treatments was so fun, and it was so obvious that there was something really powerful there that I don't think I ever had a concern that there would be something interesting on the other end of it, just because I have so much respect for these guys.
Well, I guess you have to be concerned with whether or not what you're getting is truthful. But in terms of everything working together, I mean, I think being on that kind of high wire is, I think that's the place where most great art comes from.
Absolutely.
There wasn't a question in that. I'm sorry.
I think all of us. I think all of us agree. I think we all. Well, I don't want to speak for these guys, but I definitely feel like, you know, you projects are more fun when you're not sure where you're going to end up, and it's an exploration, and you're not trying to like hammer some idea into someone's head. You're just looking for something. Sometimes you're not even sure exactly what you're looking for, but you have a general idea, and you know, that's what's fun about. About making stuff and making art is
interestingly that all that stuff is like coded in the movie too. It's all this guy on a journey who's kind of looking for something he doesn't know what he's looking for. So there's this kind of like weird, I don't know, Dave, you probably agree with me, like the weird sense of like fate surrounding stuff where I wasn't really worried just because like the whole thing felt like it was this natural, you know, natural growth process that I'm sure Dave would guide eventually. Bring somewhere really interesting. So we had a lot
I think
of kind of
both ways sometimes. Like it can cross over into that like indulgent space if you're not careful, right? Like if you're just too I know what you mean, and I definitely think that those ideas are all in the film and stuff, but it's just like it's like that thing. Since we both teach, I'm sure we've had to tell our students this a million times, where it's like just because it's your life and there are things you're interested in doesn't mean it's going to just like inherently be interesting to someone
right.
to watch. You actually still have to craft the thing and structure it. And I do think true. There was a lot of that stuff was actually is in the themes of the film or in the film. But yeah,
that's
I was worried about
it. Three different dudes, though, who have different sensibilities, and so I think there's a lot of kind of keeping things in check, you know.
Definitely.
So before I let you go, I want to ask you, Mr. Finster, what did your family think when you showed them the movie?
I was sure to show them cuts throughout the process when I was editing, and it was clear from the beginning that they were, especially my dad, was comfortable with me showing this stuff to strangers or in public. And his thing was more, he just didn't understand, like, who would want to watch him do stuff around the house or, you know, watch this particular thing.
He had a lot of doubts.
Yeah, he had more doubts than anyone, I think, about whether this thing would be entertaining at all. But we had a private, when the film was finished, we had a private screening at a theater called the Tower Theater in Miami, and it was all friends and family, and my dad was able to be there, and it was pretty great. I think he connected with the film more than he had, and he just really enjoyed talking to everybody afterwards. It was actually a really kind of emotional screening. I think he's happy with it. He seemed to like being in the theater with everybody when we watched it that time. And my mom, I think, is comfortable. She was a little worried, too, about there was certain documentary footage that almost made it into the film, but ended up not being in there with, like, my parents fighting and all this weird stuff that I ended up cutting out. But she was a little more nervous about how revealing the film would be about, you know, our family's kind of private life. But in the end, stuff that's in there just sort of worked with the film the best. And she was totally comfortable with everything that's in there, and so is he. So.
He called that screening a few weeks ago as, like, one of the greatest moments of his life. Not the greatest.
Wow.
He told me that.
Wow. Yeah, but he's always put into, like, superlatives.
Yeah, he's a little super. Yeah, that's right.
But he did have a great time, I think.
Well,
I think my birth was, like, up there, too, was great moments in his life.
It's the film and then your birth. Oh, yeah. I think